This episode of Current Geek is brought to you by Aero. Never think about Wi-Fi again when you can have brilliant, hyper-fast, super-simple Wi-Fi systems with Aero. And now, the second-generation Aero is tri-band and twice as fast as its predecessor. For free overnight shipping, visit Aero.com and check out, select overnight shipping, and then enter Current Geek, E-E-R-O.com.
You know, Mr. Bernstein, if I hadn't been very rich, I might have been a really great man.
I have
Current Geek!
Current Geek!
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to Current Geek, the weekly proceedings of the meetings of the Frog Pants All-Stars, Geeks of the World, and you to talk about all the things that matter most, especially this week anyway, as we roll towards Christmas in just a couple of days. Another movie special, everybody, with me, Scott Johnson, and Tom Merritt over there. Hello, Tom.
Hello, Scott Johnson. Yeah, this is our monthly working our way through the 100 greatest films of all time as guessed at.
Yes.
This is not a definitive list.
No.
The point was that Scott and I just wanted an excuse to watch really great movies and talk about them from our geeky perspectives that normally get shoved into the theater watching great superhero films.
That's right, or Star Wars or whatever. And right as much fun as there is happening right now discussing Star Wars in the public sphere, we think it's fun to go back a little bit. And like Tom said, we're not going off any particular single list of 100 movies. It's kind of an amalgam of lots of them, kind of generally accepted ideas that these movies are roughly in this order, or are roughly a part of this 100 movies list. And
yeah, I took like the American Film Institute list and the Rotten Tomatoes list, and I can't remember the other one now. I took three of the lists and I just kind of triangulated them to figure it out. And we've been going in reverse order from my list, and you may be saying, well, why wasn't Citizen Kane at the top? It's been at the top of so many lists, and it has.
Right.
Which is why it's near the top. But, you know, until The Godfather came out, I guess it would have easily been at the top, although it was weird that Casablanca is up there as well. But yes, this is definitely considered one of the greatest films, if not the greatest film of all time, which leads me to want to express our caveat, Scott.
Yeah, we probably ought to. We probably should do
this
that.
These episodes are Tom and Scott sitting down as regular old Joes.
Yeah.
Tom's and Scott's watching the movie and saying, okay, given the fact that we, you know, read comic books, play video games, watch superhero films and sci-fi films and love them, what do we think of this? One of the great films. This is not film critic class, especially with Citizen Kane. There are plenty of places way more qualified than that. But if you're like, hey, I just want to hear people kick this around from a different perspective than talking about the innovative film techniques or the amazing sound editing, which may bring that in, but is sort of like what you'd hear. I guess one way to put it, Scott, is what you'd hear if this were just out this week and we were giving our first impressions of it.
Yeah, and in a lot of ways, it is. I mean, all I knew, this is me admitting something pretty hardcore here. All I knew about this movie is that Orson Welles was involved.
Right.
And
you're like, that's the wine commercial guy.
Right, before its time, all that. I will not see this movie before its time, apparently. I never saw Citizen Kane in any form. I don't recall ever seeing even pieces of it. I don't remember any scenes or any kind of like TV flashbacks of like, oh, here's a scene from Citizen Kane.
It was all new to you then.
All brand new, other than I kind of knew, you know, there's the image of him in front of a podium, and behind him is the giant election poster of him.
Right.
There's a few images that I just kind of have in my head. I recall vaguely him holding a snow globe at some point, but I don't know what that was about. So there's
because in The Simpsons,
oh yeah,
you would have run into the snow globe thing. That's a pretty I don't mean to say it wasn't iconic from Citizen Kane, but it's also become an iconic Simpsons parody of, you know, among their many parodies.
Sure. And I probably didn't recognize it as such. I saw that, like most things on The Simpsons, I'll see and go, oh, that's a reference to these 400 things. And I've spent a long time, by the way, telling my kids what references they're seeing in things like The Simpsons. It's like, oh, that thing there that happened there, or in Futurama, that's a direct reference to this thing that happened in 1995, just so you all know, or whatever. So they kind of get, oh, okay, they're pulling from the past. But any Citizen Kane references that have happened in my life have gone unnoticed because I just never saw the freaking thing.
And unlike Casablanca and The Godfather, which are the other two we've seen so far,
yeah,
this one isn't really filled with as many quotable moments where you would hear them bandied about in normal conversation.
Sure. This, like, for example, this is considered a famous quote from the movie.
A fella will remember a lot of things you wouldn't think he'd remember.
But you don't hear people say that, a fella to remember a lot of things you didn't right, think you'd right. remember. It just doesn't come up.
And one of the ones that stood out to me on this watching, and I have seen it before, maybe two or three times, I think, was when he says, "I'll tell them what to think," which is honestly a quote from William Randolph Hearst. And we'll talk a little bit about that. But that's not even a quote that Mankiewicz and Welles made up in the script. It's taken from real life.
Right. So here's the other. So dancing around the elephant in the room, or the, let's call it the rosebud in the room. Oh, and I should say this.
Spoilers.
I mean, honestly, if you haven't seen it, you're still thinking, man, one day I'm going to see this movie from 1941 and you're still worried about spoilers. Yeah, we're going to talk about them. Okay. So I think this should be obvious, but I may as well say it.
I love it. I mentioned this the other day, that a 76-year-old movie had not been spoiled for you.
No, I don't know. This is amazing, actually, because I am pretty steeped in popular culture and have been my entire life. So
we all know Soylent Green is made of people. Right? Like, that's not even considered a spoiler to say anymore.
No, you just say it like it's a phrase. Yeah. So this is a movie that has it may be the first example, and perhaps one of the reasons why it's so beloved, I guess, is it's got this Easter eggy thing in it that lots of other movies do now. But, you know, if there wasn't a Citizen Kane to lead the way, would Shyamalan have a bunch of great ideas for twist endings? I don't know. Like, it feels like this might be the first ones of those things, and therefore should be so easily spoilable that I would have known about this a long time ago. But yet somehow I have never known who or what, and turns out what was the operative word, what Rosebud is.
Busy Man TM in the chat room says, "Statute of limitations on spoilers for this movie ended before you were born."
No, that's probably true. I mean, according to television creator and director, mostly, and writer of Breaking Bad, Vince Gilligan says 2 weeks is the maximum. So we are well beyond that at this stage. But I'd never heard. I'd always heard this Rosebud thing.
Yeah, that makes it into popular culture. But no one ever. Somehow, people protect the secret for this, which is crazy.
Someone will say Rosebud just in some show, and I'll go,
"Yeah,
oh, that's a Citizen Kane reference." And then I move on. I don't think too much about it. They don't really even give it away in these modern references. It's just a thing somebody says. So I knew about the connection, but I didn't know who it was. I had no idea. I assumed it was some weird thing. Like, honestly, I had in my head this, like, I had a more science fiction-y kind of thing in my head about this movie that turned out not to quite be the case. Well, at all, really. But in my in my head, I thought it was like a little more like 1984-ish, you know, kind of weird in the far-flung future, something, and it was going to be really artsy-fartsy. And the first few minutes of this movie kind of reinforced that, like the slow pan up the chain-link fence of the house, the no trespassing thing, that sort of iconic intro, and the way that castle-y building looks back there. It all seemed way Metropolis, like weirdo out there kind of thing. And it wasn't that in the end, but it seemed to support that. And so any references I had to Rosebud, I thought were steeped in some kind of weird that, you know, like that kind of stuff, some kind of science fiction. Wasn't that at all. It was just freaking, when he was a kid, he had a sled and he loved it. And it was really the only pure thing he had in his life. And then by the time he was dead, the only thing that mattered to him was the only pure thing he could remember, and it was his damn sled. And that was it. That was it.
So,
it's not a letdown. It's not a letdown, but it's different.
When you see him say Rosebud at the beginning of the movie, I want you to answer this question in three parts. When you see him say Rosebud at the beginning of the movie, what do you think it is? When you hear the reporters start to dig into it a little later in the movie and start to theorize about who it was, what did you think it was? And then how did you react when you found out it was the sled?
I found it just to be abstract, like him saying Rosebud on his deathbed and everyone else super obsessed with what he must have meant just supported the idea that it was abstract. I have no idea. Like, I really had no clue. I didn't know where he was going with it.
You weren't theorizing as you watched.
No. I mean, as we got, so when he was a kid, I went, oh, okay, this is about childhood lost. This is about parental catastrophe.
Got that.
Okay. Yeah, I got that. So I thought, well, he's now marked because of that. Like, that's messed him up. And so that's going to play a role later. I knew all of that was going to happen. But it never once did I, like, when he's fighting what's-his-name with his sled a little bit, or when he's outside screwing around with it, never once thought, oh, that sled's going to come back into play big time later.
I bet that's Rosebud.
Right.
Nailed it.
They never show the front of it, so you never see, or in those scenes, you never see that it's got this name on it. So it's never, never like a sleight of hand kind of thing, but I had no idea. I seriously had zero idea till the end. I had no idea till they showed it, and I went, man.
I remember the first time I saw it, I did not know. I knew I was like you. I had heard about Rosebud being the mystery, but people hadn't told me what it was. And so I remember feeling a little spoiled that I knew there was a mystery. I'm like, oh, so Rosebud is going to be a twist, right? It's not going to be, because I was thinking, well, it's probably a woman, right? It's a nickname for his lost love, or the one person that he, and so I kept waiting for Rosebud to show up.
Yeah.
But I'm like, but I know it's a twist.
Right.
So, you know, so I kept looking. I never thought it was the sled. And I'll be honest, the first time I viewed it, when I found out it was the sled, I'm like, well, that's dumb. It's just a sled. Like, it really didn't sink in the way it did for you, it seems, that this was about lost childhood. It took a while for me to wrap my brain around that. My immediate reaction while watching the movie, when they said it was a sled, I'm like, well, that's disappointing.
Yeah, that'd be like me dying and going, my Xbox 360 controller.
Or what are your arcade cabinets that you loved?
Right, or whatever thing, just a thing. But what I'll tell you how that hammered home for me and worked for me, though, is when there is a incredible piece of footage, and I don't know if this stuff was already all there or if they had to set this up. I just remember being very impressed watching this movie when the camera toward the end of the movie is panning over his palatial space for warehouse stuff.
Yeah.
Just all his, I mean, this really is a movie about the ultimate, what's the word? The people that keep too much stuff, they're called
hoarder.
Hoarders. This is the ultimate hoarders episode.
Yeah.
And the camera's flying over this stuff, and it's just junk and furniture and antiques and all these things. Lots of furniture. For some reason, he was way into the furniture. Mm-hmm.
They made a big deal about statues.
Yes, statues were big. So this slow pan over all of this stuff is really effective. The music's really cool, and it's kind of jaw-droppingly visually, like, whoa, look at, I mean, this is a lot. And it represents a very whacked out, confused man, mind, all that stuff. Like, there's all of these metaphors that you can see. And as it just zooms into that thing, I went, oh, that's the thing. That's it. That must be Rosebud. Before they even showed the name, because you don't see the name till it's in the fire.
Uh-huh.
And then they went in there and cherry-picked that out of this giant warehouse and threw that in, I don't know. There's plenty of other stuff to, like, start burning.
Also, why are they burning it?
I don't know.
I think they just have an estate sale and, you know, somebody pick it up for $5.
They don't like the ozone layer down there or something. But, when they get that, I was a little confused about why that got picked first. But whatever. It's a movie. But there were lots of, and that brings me to my next point. There's a lot of stuff in this movie that really genuinely surprised me that it's this old, but it was doing things that seem, how do I put this?
Modern.
Very modern. Like, you can, I'll tell you the movies I was immediately reminded of. For some reason, the most recent thing it reminded me of was Coco, and I can't figure it out why, except there's this scene in Coco where they're in the world of the dead. And they're in this giant palace, and there's very, very reminiscent of that, like long shadows and echoey voices and tall spaces and this sort of stuff. But it also reminded me of, like, the Hudsucker Proxy, where it's supposed to be set in a real place, but it's just surrealistic enough to be otherworldly. There's times like that in this movie. There's also, like, incredible makeup for 1941. Like, I don't know how they pulled off his aging effects. I still am kind of blown away by that.
He spent 4 hours in the chair, apparently, for those scenes where he was aged and had to wear these painful contacts to change his eyes. I mean, we think, oh, the special effects are new, but practical effects have been around for a long time in Hollywood.
Yeah, and not only that, you know, this movie's full of, hey, what you got going there, see? Like, there's plenty of bad acting, like acting of the time. From plenty of actors and stuff. But then there are moments where you're like, oh my gosh, that was like really good.
That's the way people actually talked back then.
Well, then it's the greatest acting in the world. But there would be times where I just like, oh my gosh, Orson Welles, you are freaking killing it. Like, you are eating this scene up and you're doing it in a way that's believable. The way your eyes are darting around. Like, this doesn't feel like stage work. This feels like something more. And it gave me a greater appreciation for his, always talked about but never understood by me anyway, his brand of genius.
Yeah.
Which was like, well, you know.
And one of the reasons that Welles was turned into a legend was War of the Worlds, the radio play, right. Obviously.
Right.
But Citizen Kane was another one because it was his first movie.
Yeah.
He'd never directed a movie. He'd never acted in a movie. He'd never written a movie. Now, he'd done a lot of other preparatory work, mostly stage stuff and radio stuff. So he knew dramatic beats. He knew how to write dialogue. You know, he knew acting from voice. He knew acting from movement. But things like eyes darting around, that doesn't play on a stage. Certainly doesn't play on radio.
No.
You know, so he, what's impressive, what's most impressive to me reading the little bit that I did about the history of the making of the movie is I either forgotten or didn't realize just how new he was to this. And apparently he spent a lot of time on the studio lot at RKO watching other films and milking other executives and cinematographers for advice. Like, you know, how do you do this shot? Why do you do it that way? And there's a great story about the cinematographer, Greg Toland, who was apparently borrowed from Goldwyn's studio because Toland wanted to work on it with Welles. And Toland was like top of his game, right? He was like top cinematographer of the day.
Right.
But he wanted to work with Welles because he's like, this guy's smart enough to do good stuff, but inexperienced enough not to know he shouldn't try it. And I want to see what I can do. Which is, that's one of the things that I didn't realize about why this movie is so innovative is it's not that anything in it necessarily is new.
Right.
I think, you know, again, we're verging on the film criticism here, and I don't really know what I'm talking about. But from what I've read, you know, everything that was done in Citizen Kane had been tried before in other films, but nobody had done it all at once.
Right.
And some of the techniques that Toland used, he invented on the spot to make it happen. So, you know, they talk about, you know, the focus, the fact that he was able to have this deep focus and everything. That was because Toland was like, man, I want to work with somebody smart who doesn't know what they're doing.
Yeah.
Because they're not going to they're not going to hold back. And I'm not going to tell them you can't do it because I want to try stuff.
I think you're right. There's a feeling of things not being tied down to convention, which just really struck me. I didn't expect any of this, by the way. I'm thinking 41. All right. I know what I'm getting here. Bad sound, horrible editing. Everyone faces the camera as if they're on stage because that's how they're trained. It's going to be a lot of that sort of stuff. And instead, it's these thoughtful pans and interesting angles and crazy shots. There's a shot early in the film where there are executives, or I guess they're, I guess they all work for the newsreel, whatever their capacity is. But they're all in that small viewing room watching that newsreel. And when it's over, the top dude standing up talking about what they need to do next and all of this, and he is getting some of the coolest, like, light cast shadow weird stuff I've ever seen. It reminded me of Dark City. It reminded me of, like, a lot of movies I really respect that are more modern. Had no idea that this would have either A, been an influence on those, or B, existed all the way back in 41. I thought everything in the 40s looked like, I don't know, freaking
like the factory movies, right? Yeah,
yes,
where they, like, crank them out.
Yeah,
I mean, this movie was made for less than $1 million, but still, that's a lot of money in 1941.
Mm-hmm.
And even though the war hadn't started yet, unlike Casablanca, this one came out before the war started.
Yeah.
RKO was trying to pinch some pennies because they couldn't play movies in Europe a lot. They weren't making a lot of money because the war had started over there, even if the U.S. hadn't gotten into it yet.
Right. I forget, and that's the other thing you just keep forgetting. This is all during wartime, so there's maybe even like a weird energy to it.
Well, it's that weird time where the U.S. is not in the war, so everything's fine here. But
right.
Roosevelt definitely is, you know, pushing us towards it. We're helping out England. We're starting to take a side.
Yeah.
And so everybody's on the knife edge of, like, you know, we don't know what's going to happen, which makes those scenes where Kane comes out and like, there will be no war, and showing him meeting Hitler. you know, I've run into a lot of these recently where you see things, the Crown has talked about this, of people dealing with Hitler before World War II.
Mm-hmm.
And the perceptions of him are so different than they are now, obviously.
Yeah.
You know, there's you want to condemn people for that, but this movie made before that is sort of, you know, playing into the part of like, yeah, nobody knew he was Hitler yet.
No.
They just thought he was an extreme leader who was doing extreme things, but yeah. It wasn't above board.
Sure, sure. He was like this charismatic guy who changed things in Europe, and you didn't know yet. And that's pretty fascinating. Also, whoever they got to play Hitler up there, freaking nailed it, dude. Freaking looked just like Hitler. That freaked me out a little bit. I went, wait a minute. That's not really Hitler standing there, is it? It turns out.
That one I don't know, because Kane's near him, right?
Yeah, he's standing right near him. And unless they got real good with split screen something back then.
I don't think so, no. Because there was a guy who played Roosevelt. In the scenes, obviously.
Yeah, it looked like
A lot of the footage in that newsreel was real newsreel footage. He got the RKO newsreel folks to edit that part of the film so that it would feel like a newsreel.
Sure, but it was just, I don't know, surprisingly effective.
Also, it struck me that starting Citizen Kane with a newsreel is a little bit of a publicity stunt, in that everyone knows Orson Welles is the guy who tricked people into thinking that a real Martian invasion was happening.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And so he starts with a parody of news.
Yeah.
And cinemas started with newsreels back in the day. You would run a newsreel before the main feature quite often.
Right.
So it was a little bit of a fake out of like, this is what is classic Wells. He's, you know, starting with fake news.
Well, okay. I guess that actually brings me to another little weird parallel that I couldn't get out of my head, and something that reminded me, something that jumped out at me, was that the movie seems to chronicle the rise and you know, ultimately sort of at least sort of spiritual or internal fall of a man, but externally it reminds me of not that different than our day. So then he's a newspaper man, right? He makes all his money in newspapers and you know, figures out a way to harness that, and then he builds other stuff on top of that and has radio networks and all these things, and it just couldn't help but find parallels in the modern sort of tech race of Facebook or anything else, where, you know, you start with some small idea and it becomes this huge thing, and then you got more money than God, and you know, what does that mean? And it still works in that way. All those metaphors still work. It didn't feel like some antiquated time of, oh, now remember the old days of radio. Like, it's just a different tech for a different time. But it was like watching another Bezos, another Elon Musk, another Mark Zuckerberg rise in his time, and that worked for me. Totally worked for me. Like, didn't feel unrealistic. Didn't feel, you know, weird at all. He's in his 20s, scrappy, sleeves rolled up. He's right there at that old building working on this newspaper. It's not that different than Zuckerberg in his living room, you know, cranking out ideas. And
A large portion of the character of Charles Foster Kane is based on William Randolph Hearst.
Yeah.
And of course, Hearst banned his papers from mentioning Citizen Kane because of that. But Hearst was the Bezos of his day, I guess, in a lot of ways.
Yeah. I like one of the things I liked most about, speaking of, you know, the things that they did then that they do now that we just take for granted. If you go see a movie now and all you get is a title, you just think that's normal, right? And there's plenty of examples of movies where they run credits throughout the whole start, or sometimes, you know, on TV it's common to have the credits roll as people are doing dialogue. But in this film, completely off the rails in terms of the order in which they did those things. Just the title, no stars' names, completely unprecedented in 41. It is now kind of the norm, like the entire industry does it.
And listen, when Scott says completely unprecedented, please don't send him five examples of movies
that
did this before. We're saying it's really unusual.
Yeah, very unusual. I won't say it's 100% the only time anyone had ever done it, But it was unique in that way, certainly for something with as much notoriety as it had. And it's small, like it's just a small thing, but I felt it. Like, I'm used to seeing these old movies, including ones you and I have watched, like Casablanca, where the entire opening sequence is about making sure all your stars get their names out there.
And the cinematographers and the producers. Sure. And yeah, that's all done usually beforehand. And what really drives it home is at the end, when he does a credit scene that says, most of these people are new to you. Mm-hmm. Joseph Cotten, for instance. And you see, you know, he uses footage of each actor as they credit them.
Also weird, right? I thought, and for a hot second, I thought I was going to get outtakes. Like, I was like, oh, yeah, man, right. What's this? There's going to be jokey screw-up scenes. No, there wasn't any of that, but it was mostly lines.
Did you happen to watch the trailer?
I didn't know there's a trailer. I guess
it's worth watching. Because the trailer, and it's understandable that you might skip it because you're like, I just watched the movie. I don't really need to see the trailer. But the trailer was innovative too, because there's no footage from the movie in it.
Oh, weird.
It was all shot separately as a behind the scenes look at the making of Citizen Kane.
Oh, interesting. That's super weird. You don't even see that much today. Like, that's an odd choice. For your trailer. I guess they weren't watching trailers on, you know, their iPads in 1941, but they were seeing these before, I guess, other movies and newsreels and things like that. You'd see, I assume that's when you'd see this stuff.
Yeah.
But that's fascinating. Hey guys, taking a quick break here in the middle of things to talk about our friends over at Aero, E-E-R-O. The single router model just doesn't work really anymore. I don't know if you guys are like me, but I got rooms where I just can't get freaking good Wi-Fi because of problems like that. Simple physics, like light waves. Wi-Fi waves travel and they don't go through walls very well. Imagine asking a light bulb in your living room to light your master bedroom. You might get a little faint something from the hallway, but it's not really the same, is it? With Aero, you can install an enterprise-grade Wi-Fi system in your home in just a few minutes. All right? Now, they're excited to introduce a second-generation Aero and Aero Beacon. Aero home Wi-Fi system started in early 2016. Since then, they've learned from hundreds of thousands of systems, making their smarter, faster, and more reliable systems now. The new Aero second-generation and Aero Beacon allow customers to build a Wi-Fi system that is more perfectly tailored to their home than ever before. With the addition of the new Thread radio, Aero can connect to low power devices such as locks, doorbells, other sensors, and more. Expanding your coverage to every room easily with Aero Beacon. Simply plug it into a wall and you're covered. Can you imagine your life with full Wi-Fi coverage everywhere? I can imagine it. I really like the Aero system a lot, and I think you're going to too. For free overnight shipping to the U.S. or Canada, visit Aero.com, that's E-E-R-O.com, and check out, select overnight shipping, and then enter Current Geek to make it free. Oh, these guys are great. Still time to get it. Make your Christmas a little merrier with awesome Wi-Fi. Aero.com, enter Current Geek and make it free. Select that overnight shipping. And we thank them for sponsoring the show. There's a great line in this from a really disheveled, frazzled man that works at the paper that I need to play because, I don't know, there's something about this that reminded me of today. So here it is.
It's not our function to report the gossip of housewives. If we were interested in that kind of thing, Mr. Kane, we could fill the paper twice over daily.
It just feels like
That's the editor-in-chief of the Inquirer when Kane takes over as publisher.
Yeah, right? Yeah. And he's just, that guy needs a break. He needs a vacation. He needs 7 days out somewhere nice where he can just chill and sip on martinis or something, because he is messed up. But
oh, he's 19th century through and through. Yeah, and this is a 20th century paper, by God.
And the actor himself was, of course, born in, like, I don't know, 1860 or some crazy early number. But anyway, I could not help but watch this movie through the lens of 2017. It was impossible for me. And I think about the media landscape that is the newspapers of today, meaning, you know, back then it was, you know, this one or two sources in your town that told you everything you needed to know, and that's what you got. Eventually radio and TV supplemented that, but that was kind of it. And I think about 2017, and it is so much more vast than that. And it is so many voices talking to me at once. And right now, as I speak, as I speak on Twitter, somebody's trying to get my attention and tell me a thing. Like, just burp, 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 constantly.
Right.
And I can't help but think about how wrong that guy was. Like, he basically made an argument against 24-hour news networks, against the idea of on all the time sort of sources of information. And it was like this, this hard example of, yeah, well, sorry, dude, the 19th century way of getting your stuff done is about to go away. And here we are bringing in the new. And it was really poignant and felt.
Well, it's a great reminder that yellow journalism isn't new.
Right.
That a lot of this stuff that people are like, you know, journalism used to be solid and stayed. And it's like, no, there's always been a tension. There's always been, you know, a drift of whether journalism was going to be a little more sensationalistic or a little more. And it goes back and forth. And even though this is a movie, it's depicting the real thing that happened with William Randolph Hearst coming in and many others, not just Hearst, but many others coming in and saying, you know, if we can fill the paper twice over with gossip, let's do it. It'll sell papers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, and he was it was no secret, at least in the stuff I could find and read, that William Randolph Hearst was not happy about this movie, did not like the idea that he was the unnamed inspiration for the character.
Well, and that's another thing that gets simultaneously blown out of proportion, but also undercredited by Wells himself. Wells said, no, he never mentioned Hearst. He said it had nothing to do with anyone in one individual, which is literally true. It's an amalgamation, but a lot of it really is. I mean, the fact, you know, I'll tell the people what they think, and, you know, you got your war with Spain. It's like, those are both 100% Hearst events, their history. So those are pulled from his life. A lot of it's pulled from his life. The stuff with the opera singer, though, the stuff with building the opera house in Chicago,
right.
Those are apparently Samuel Insull and Harold McCormick, two Chicago tycoons. And so it's not one person. Some of the stuff is even drawn from Wells' own life. Some of it is drawn from Mankiewicz's life, you know, so it is an amalgam.
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't call him Hearst,
right.
You know, they didn't call him, Bob Gandalf Horst, you know, they called him Charles Foster Kane. Although I guess three names, that's that giveaway.
Bob Gandalf Horst is my favorite thing I've heard in a few weeks. Easy. That's really good. Anyway, so here's a story. Now, I have save your emails because I have no way to verify this story about Hearst and Orson Welles, but I think it's interesting. Sources say, okay, on the night of the movie, the night the movie opened in San Francisco, Orson Welles found himself alone in a elevator with William Randolph Hearst in the city's Fairmont Hotel. Aware that his father and Hearst were friends, Welles extended an invitation to the magnate to attend the film's premiere. Hearst turned down the offer as he was about to exit the elevator at his floor. Welles remarked the following, quote, Charles Foster Kane would have accepted, unquote. Now, I don't know if that interaction's true, but
it's a great story, though,
I love
right?
it. Yeah, I love
Charles Foster Kane would have accepted. I mean, and it's the kind of thing Charles Foster Kane would have said.
Yeah.
If Charles Foster Kane had been in somehow that position, weirdly.
Another admission of guilt. This is a little guilty thing of mine, but the only thing I ever really knew Orson Welles from until I was in my probably mid-20s was he made a cameo in the Muppet movie. Do you remember that? He showed up and turned around at the end and was all, this was in his days where you could take up a whole chair and just have that beard and no wine before it's time thing. And that's it. That's all I knew. I knew that voice. And so for a long time, that was Orson Welles for me. So to know that he was this auteur, this, you know, groundbreaking, change the world dude, I didn't know any better. I feel a little dumb for it, to be honest. I feel like it's something I should have known more about.
That is the tragedy of Orson Welles is that, you know, he is best known as being in a wine commercial by so many people, sadly. You will sell no wine before it's time. Yeah. Maybe his famous line. If you know him for his real work, it's probably War of the Worlds. You're like, oh, that guy from the wine commercial. He also made War of the Worlds back in the 30s. Who knew?
Yeah.
But Citizen Kane is his greatest work, and it's the first movie he makes. He never makes a better movie by all general consensus.
Right.
And that's kind of the curse of the freshman, you know, of the rookie of the year. If you come out that strong with a movie, and granted, he'd done so much other art before that. It's not like this is his first effort, but his first movie is so huge. Everyone expects every movie he makes after that to be Citizen Kane, which is especially odd given that Citizen Kane didn't do so well at the box office.
No, it didn't do great. It also...
it didn't make its money back.
No, it's one
and you didn't have worldwide distribution during World War II. And you didn't have merchandising. You know, you can go buy your mini rosebud keychains.
Yeah. Well, I mean, one of the things about that people will say about genius is it doesn't always happen at the time you do it. In other words, people just don't get it, or they don't understand it, or this seems too far out there. Like, this must have seemed crazy to people. Because it is a very different kind of movie. Flashbacks and flash forwards and
right.
Just like ideas that all seem normal and mundane to us now. But back then, that was nuts. This wasn't a narrative.
Again, a few other movies had done it before, but not as high profile as this.
And sometimes the best art just takes forever for its appreciation to happen. It's why, you know... the masters, their paintings don't sell for jack while they're alive, but they do really well later. It's because people, you know, you have to grow to it. They have to adhere to it. They have to figure it out. And I, you know, and not that he had a bad career or, you know, died penniless or anything weird like that, but it, you know, I know I didn't appreciate him for what this was. And yes, he had help from the screenwriter that was, you know, famously involved and others, but it's hard not to give this dude a lot of credit for it. Starring, directing, producing, making, pushing, like,
well, and let's not short shrift Mankiewicz. There has been a lot of controversy over how much each of them was involved in the actual writing of the script. At times, people claiming that Welles just put his name on it, and Mankiewicz did all the work, but it really was a collaborative effort. Again, if I understand it right, they both wrote versions of the story. They, you know, they agreed on the story, and then they both wrote versions of it, and then they kind of merged those scripts together, and that creative tension probably is one of the reasons the movie is so good, because that's a recipe for either a mess of a movie where nothing makes sense, or the magic of the best of both minds being incorporated, which I think is what we ended up getting.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with that. Now, here's fun little idea for you. When I was growing up, I didn't know the difference between William Burr and Orson Welles. To me, same guy. So I'd see that detective or that lawyer show. What was that? William Burr show? I forget what it's called. Anyway, he'd come out and solve crimes. Anyway, that guy. William Burr and Orson Welles, to me in my head, and even today, I have
to. You mean Raymond Burr?
Or did I say William Burr? I meant Raymond Burr.
Yeah.
Who the hell's William Burr?
See, you don't even know the difference between William Burr and Raymond Burr, much less Orson Welles. Perry Mason.
Perry Mason is the show. Yeah. Sorry, Raymond Burr. I could not get the difference, but I still in my head can't separate them. To me, they're sitting there in the same chair looking exactly like the same dude. And for all I know, he was the one in the Muppet movie, and I'm forgetting it wrong, or remembering it wrong. Like, that is a weird thing I have, and I can't shake it, and I apologize to both the Burrs and the Wells, for my inability to separate those two men as individuals. It's just.
Did you ever see them together?
No, I never did. Now that you mention it,
that is an exercise left for the audience. Find footage or photographic evidence of Orson Welles and Raymond Burr ever in the same place, right? Or William Burr.
Yeah.
Either one.
William Burr, I got, you know, just
for Aaron Burr. We don't care.
This is going to bug me, so I got to find out who actual William Burr is. There is no William Burr.
According to Wikipedia, there is, or I'm sorry, according to a Google search, William Burr is senior analyst at the National Security Archive.
Oh, and maybe I'm also thinking of Bill Burr, the comedian. Yeah. That might be it. Yeah, I don't know. Anyway, point is, those guys, you know, big, broad men of a certain age who... you might see a cigar hanging from the side of their face, and they might be, there's something about those dudes I just always
conflate. Well, and there's something about Orson Welles too that, you know, you remember him as the Raymond Burr like older Orson Welles from the Muppet movie, obviously. But when you see him in Citizen Kane, he's an entirely different person. Even when they age him, they don't age him into the actual Orson Welles that will end up being old. That's not what he looks like. He gets much heavier. For
no, he doesn't look anything like that. But yeah, it's still convincing. Like there were times I had to remind myself, this is a 25-year-old director and actor. 25, by the way, is in, I mean, whatever. Maybe that's why it's so genius, because he's young and scrappy and's got nothing to worry about. Just like the world's the limit. But he is looking like what he's supposed to look like across that movie. And I never once go, he doesn't look that old, or that looks like a young guy with too much makeup on, or whatever. Whereas I did feel that way about a couple of his buddies in the later, the ones that supposedly grow up and they're being interviewed about Rosebud. I
went, they don't spend as much money on Bernstein, do they?
No, they don't. They didn't want to spend all that time in the chair, I guess, but they weren't as convincing. He was always convincing. Always. And it always felt like, oh, this is the part. Like, there's a scene. I even have a line from it. Let's see.
It's funny. When you manage the budget, you can get them to spend more money on your makeup.
Yeah, it's true, right? Okay, here. Let's see. Is this the one?
You're right, Mr. Thatcher. I did lose $1 million last year. I expect to lose $1 million this year. I expect to lose $1 million next year. You know, Mr. Thatcher, at the rate of $1 million a year, I'll have to close this place in 60 years.
All right, that was a different scene, but he was younger there. But the point is that when he's sitting down and they're having the financial trouble at one point, and he's sitting with his partners talking to him, he looks like a guy in his mid-50s, and it's never once distracting. I never once go, oh, well, I sure wish they'd have done that different or whatever. That was super impressive, and I don't even see that today. Like, Benjamin Button feels weird half the time, and you see movies where somebody's playing older, and I don't buy it, but I totally bought this. And maybe it's the black and white, maybe it's the harsh shadows, the noir filmmaking style, something.
It but, helps, yeah.
Yeah, it's really impressive. It's kind of blown
well away. Hats off to sci-fi guy number two. Raymond Burr and Orson Welles co-starred in the 1949 film Black Magic.
Oh my lord, really?
Let's so see. There, they can finally separate them in your mind this if you watch that.
8 years later than this. Let's see. Yeah, this is the movie I've never seen, although I have heard, and chat room, maybe you can confirm this, because you're as good a source of info as my head. Wasn't Orson Welles also known as like a really kick-a magician? Like that guy could do some rad magic, I heard. Like cool stage
Orson
magic.
Welles?
Yeah, that's
I had not heard that before.
I even want to kind of say I was told this once by friend Brian Brushwood, but Houdini says that. Houdini said, "Well, hey, his name's Houdini7 in the chat room. He must know." Oh, he was trained by Houdini? What? Okay, that's maybe deeper even than I thought. But I thought somewhere I'd heard that guy could get up and magic his way through a crowd in a pretty serious way. And that's interesting from just the angle of what a someone who's into illusion and tricking you and stuff kind of makes sense. He'd go on to do War of the Worlds and freak everybody out, or make a movie like Citizen Kane and change up everything and flip the script. And, I don't know, there's something about magicians that they do that stuff. Even the ones I know, they're innovative thinkers and they do all kinds of crazy stuff. So that's crazy. Wow.
All right. I've waited this long into our conversation to admit this, because Godfather, amazing movie. Yeah. Love that movie. Could watch it over and over and over again. Right. Casablanca, my favorite movie of all time.
Right.
I don't really like Citizen Kane that much.
You didn't like it very much, you say?
I don't like it that much. I mean, I'm not saying it's a bad movie. I did. Please don't throw the tomatoes at me. But I'm talking about pure visceral enjoyment, okay?
Right,
not criticism. I am super appreciative of the complexity of the script and how groundbreaking it was in so many ways and the incredible shots that you're talking about. I do not deny any of that. Just at the end of the day, when I'm done watching it or while I'm watching it, I don't enjoy it as much.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not gonna... Yeah, I agree. I can't disagree with that. I don't... like, again, it's not about the things that... there's innovation all over the place.
Yeah.
But yeah, from just like a raw, like sort of story rewatchable sort of standpoint, especially in the wake of, let's just say this thing invented all modern cinema conventions, like all the cool things we do with movies now, they all owe a piece of thanks to Citizen Kane. Well, that's part of the problem, is that we've been the benefactors all these years, you know, near 80 years later, to still see that influence and still have it, and have it be from things that are from our time, and we don't think of it as, you know, oh, we, but before every movie, say a quick prayer to Citizen Kane, you know, like we don't do that. And yeah. So we don't, you have to only look at it for what it is. And it's a story about a dude who's, you know, young and scrappy and then rich and then cranky and then can't stay with the same people and then blows his political career and then dies in a sad way. And his childhood was a problem. Like,
spoilers.
Yeah. But all of those things, none of them are like super like, oh, that's a story I've never heard. Like, it would have been in 41, but not now. You know?
Well, and you know, I think it's important because there is an undercurrent and implicit assumption discussing movies these days that you either are right or wrong about whether you liked it or not.
Yeah.
You know, and if there's any subtlety to the conversation, someone will say, well, maybe it's a good movie, but I didn't like it. And it's, you know, but mostly it's that movie was bad, that movie was good.
Yeah.
And I think Citizen Kane is a great example for me of it's more complex than that. You can enjoy a bad movie. Look at The Room. Look at the success of a movie like that.
Sure.
It's objectively bad and people enjoy it. And you cannot enjoy a good movie defined as like this movie does everything right. It's innovative. It's technically amazing. But maybe after you see it once, you don't need to watch it again. So those are two different things, right? Mm-hmm. I don't say I didn't enjoy watching Citizen Kane or I didn't think it was good.
Right.
I just don't need to see it again. And that's a different thing than something like, I don't know, Lord of the Rings or Star Wars or even The Matrix, where it's like, yeah, put it on, I'll watch it again. Harry Potter, put it on, I'll watch it again. Yeah. Some of those movies are not good.
Right.
But that's a different thing. Like, am I going to enjoy just having it on for whatever reason because it stokes a sentimental feeling in me, or I like how it looks or how it makes me feel? That's a different thing, you know, and there's so many different types of good and so many different types of bad. And it's always about the experience you bring into any story, whether it's a book, a movie, or a video game, that decides whether you're going to enjoy it or not. It's not 100% on the side of the movie. I'm not absolving. I'm not saying everything's relativistic. Right. You know, some movies are going to be objectively just impossible for most people to enjoy, but none of us get the same experience out of any movie. And so Citizen Kane, as universally lauded as it is, and some people can rewatch it over and over and just, you know, bask in it because that's what they love. What stokes their feelings is the intricacy of the flashbacks in the story or just enjoying all the different cinematic perspectives. It doesn't do that for me, but that doesn't mean I'm bad or it's bad.
No. Also, you know, I don't know, contextually. So how do I put this? Like The Sixth Sense, here's a good example. That movie was pretty great when it dropped. Shyamalan was an unknown. People freaked out. The twist in that movie was huge. And a lot of people, including me, didn't see it coming. And when I did, I was like, whoa, mind blown. But you know what movie I can't watch again? It's The Sixth Sense. And I wonder if this suffers from that just a little bit. Because this is a very early example of, here's a movie sandwich. The first piece of bread is like a weird word. It comes out of a dude's mouth and we don't know why. And at the end, you finally get payoff from that. And once you do, the mystery's gone. So the interactive part is gone. It doesn't exist anymore. So what you're
and
left with...
And it's
not
like the entire movie is made up of just that, right?
Right.
Some twist movies, it's like, once you know the twist, there's no reason, like, there's nothing else to it.
Sure.
That's not true of Citizen Kane, but it is a big part of it.
Sure. And I would even argue that, like, in Sixth Sense, there's some incredible acting, like Toni Collette, who plays the kid's mom, is underrated as one of the most powerful things in that movie. Like, there's a lot of really cool things about it. But because I know how that twist goes, it's like, well... I mean, so that's not a thing I'm going to turn on and watch on my own. Now, that being said, if I was with some friends of similar interests and we were like, let's watch Citizen Kane and talk about it while we watch it, I'd do that.
Yeah, because there's a lot to talk about.
There, I totally would, and that's why I would say this. If they want me to watch Citizen Kane again, here's what you do. There was a 70-year anniversary Blu-ray in 2011 or something to that effect. If you want to really get me, what you do is you release a Blu-ray or some format that is chock full of really important directors, actors, whoever's who have been influenced by this thing, just commentating the hell out of it. It doesn't even have to be Orson Welles. You can have some old audio of him, but I'd love to hear Scorsese and Spielberg.
The digital copy that I bought has two director comment, like not Orson Welles, but two commentary tracks from prominent directors.
And I could get into that. That I think I could do again from, you know, for most movies, actually. Like even dumb movies, I'm always fascinated by the process and the thinking behind the scenes and stuff like that. So it'd be at least one more out of me for viewing that. But I also have one other theory, and this is a little more esoteric, but we can play with it. I wonder if the older I get, and this is, I'll just speak for me, the older I get, the less I want to go do a thing again and more want to go find a thing that's new. So what ends up happening is I'll see something rad, even something that's so in my wheelhouse, like I've only seen Rogue One once. I've only seen we own them on Blu-ray because that's just what you do. But I've seen that one time in the theater, and I saw Star Wars Episode 7 twice in the theater, and the new one once. Obviously, it's not on any other kind of format, but those are the kind of movies I used to watch incessantly. But now these days, I'm just like, I'll watch it. I'm good. I'll see the new whatever, and then I'm good. And I seek other things. I used to play video games over that I loved. I want to go back and revisit them, and that's still sort of the case in some really ancient cases. But for the most part, it's like, all right, I've beaten that. I am now going to move on to something different and new and not dwell too much on rehashing the thing I just beat. I don't know if that's a thing or not. It's definitely a thing for me, though.
Yeah, yeah. It's part of the thing for me, too, because there's an associated effect I've noticed where if I sit down and I'm like, well, I'm just going to put something on.
Yeah.
There are some movies where I'm like, like Rogue One's a good example of like, oh, maybe I'll put that on. And then I'm like, let me find something else.
Right.
I saw Rogue One twice in the theater because I always see Star Wars twice at least because I do pretend I'm dumb about Star Wars and I have to take notes on one of them. But I bought the digital copy and I think I played part of it.
Yeah.
After I bought it, I don't think I've played it all the way through since.
Yeah, because
there is that weird. Have you ever had the showroom effect where there's like maybe it's a movie you even own that you just won't put on? You keep like, no. But then you go into like a Best Buy or a Costco and it's on one of the display TVs and you just get captivated.
Yes, that does happen. In fact, it happens more than I'd like. It's the Netflix thing for me. It's like there's a Netflix original that I must see and everyone's raving about it. In my head, I go, yeah, I should. And I almost started it three times, but I didn't because I thought, I'll go find something that's not going to be here forever. You know, let me see something that I know that is not going to be here in a month. And then I'll come back to that eventually. And then I just kind of never do. And then it's like that. It's weird. Maybe it's because of the breadth of choice we have now. It used to be all you could do was watch Star Wars on VHS again, because what else did you have that was that good to watch over again?
Because Citizen Kane is one of those for me where if it just popped up, I'd be captivated. I'd be
right.
Like, oh, yeah, right.
Now, I have
but
three.
I'm not going to vote to sit down. I'm not going to choose to sit down and watch it again, I don't think, very often, which is why I really want some set-top box maker or some service to allow me to create a playlist of movies that I can just, when I'm like, I don't know what I want to watch, play my playlist of movies and it will just pop you in the middle of one.
Yeah.
Doesn't even have to be at the beginning.
Yeah.
As if it were a constantly running personal movie channel. I so want that.
That is, I'll bet that's, at some point somebody will figure that out and it'll be smart and it'll know the best stuff and all that. So the chat room's pointing out a couple of examples where it seems like I'm being hypocritical and I want to at least address this. I have three exemptions to the thing I just said.
Uh-huh.
I will, at any time anyone suggests it, wants to, or otherwise thinks I should, watch the following three movies. And I will watch them over again and over again and over again. And I do not seem to tire of any of these three. And that would be, the most recent example is Mad Max Fury Road. I could watch that right this second. Waterworld. And you might say, Scott, that's not even a good movie. I know it's not. But there's something about Waterworld that I love. And you might even find reasons in Mad Max Fury Road that I love Waterworld so much. Genre speaking, it's like speaks to me. And then third is Serenity. I've seen Serenity 21 times now.
Yeah.
21 times of that movie. I've not even seen this TV series more than 1.5 times. So it isn't like I'm some kind of freaky Firefly fan. I just love Serenity. I think that is one of the most perfect movies I ever saw. And so I'll watch that right now if someone asks me to.
I constantly watch Firefly and Serenity. I just have them on every device that I can find.
Just playing right now.
If I'm on a plane or something and I don't know what else to watch, it's always the thing I go to on my tablet.
Tom's got it on his phone right now. He's looking at it while we're recording a podcast.
Yeah, I'm like, it's great. Oh, Deep on the Wind.
And others are mentioning things like, you know, Shawshank Redemption. Yes, like, of course. Then there's the seasonal stuff. I can watch Planes, Trains, and Automobiles at least once a year. Like, there are definitely exceptions, but for the most part, there's so many choices and so many things to see. And also, Oscar-worthy material sometimes isn't the most rewatchable material.
Yeah. Well, Moonlight. Mm-hmm. Moonlight. Yeah, you know, great movie.
Yeah.
Not something I need to sit through again anytime soon because it's hard.
Yeah.
And that's why it's great.
Yeah. Yeah. So, well, I mean, we are going to get to Saving Private Ryan or possibly, you know, Schindler's List or some of these movies that are hard to watch twice. You know what I mean? Like, you know what they are and you know they're special and you'll see them and you'll go, oh, well, there's a reason why this is hallowed as one of the great things not only Spielberg ever did, but perhaps one of the best war movies ever, blah, blah, blah. Those are all true things. But what is also true is they're about, you know, some of the worst of humanity and they're hard to watch. So, you know, we'll do it for this show, for our list, but I think that's an important thing. People like their, you know, it's the same reason I can... And you can't eat burgers every day and you can't eat, you know,
not a good idea.
Caviar every day. Yeah. If you eat caviar every day, you can smell like a damn fish.
So, yeah.
So
really.
You'll
become a fish.
Oh, wow.
Which reminds me, not the fish part, but the, you know, we're going to watch movies like this in the future part. Yeah. Next month will be Psycho.
Oh, my gosh.
The original Psycho, 1960, Hitchcock.
Yeah,
Psycho.
I've been ages since I've seen that, so I'm excited.
And then just looking down the list, if you're curious, like what else is on the horizon? Sunset Boulevard, Wizard of Oz, Rear Window, Schindler's List, Singing in the Rain, and more.
Yeah, a bunch of those I've not seen, but I have seen some. And so, once again, Scott continues down the road of watching old stuff he thought was grandma movies, but now has a greater appreciation of because he's old and he gets it. Whereas Tom was always a seasoned, cultured person.
Oh, we will eventually run across some turnabouts in this list.
Oh, all right.
Where I know you have seen it and I have not. That'll be fun.
I'm pretty excited about it. Well, thank you all for joining us. We hope you enjoyed hanging out with us. Did want to play one final clip, or did I already play it? I may have already played it. Yeah, I played it. It's the one about losing money. He's great. That is to say, Orson Welles, and Citizen Kane is pretty rad. And if you've never seen it, I do recommend that. You know, whether you decide it's a repeat viewer for you, I don't know, but
yeah, you should see it at least once.
I feel better having seen it and feel weirdly more complete as a person who claims he likes movies and sort of digs on how movies are made and shown and, you know, received.
Well,
so
it's that perspective setting of it. Mm-hmm. Even if you've, even with me who's seen it before, just being reminded about, oh, wow, this is 1941, and they're doing that, like you said.
It's this is damn sled, chat room says. That's right. Well, our sled is telling you we hope you all have a fantastic and merry Christmas and holiday season, which is, gosh, coming to a close soon. A couple days till Christmas. We hope you're enjoying you and yours. We'll be back. I don't know when. When's our next show? Is it next?
Not January.
Something.
The
5th of January. So in 2018 is when you will hear from us again, which really isn't that far now, folks. But we hope you are all having a great time. Before we get out of here, Tom, Merritt, anything you'd like to mention to the fine people at home before we go?
Just take care of yourselves. Have a great holiday break. I hope you get one, at least a little bit of a one.
Yeah.
And be kind to each other.
Oh.
So it's always easier to be mad than to be kind. So when you're feeling mad, try to flip that.
Yeah.
I'll do it too.
And me too. Yeah. I'm trying to be better about that. It's been a weird year, but
yeah,
but thanks for being along with us for this year, everybody. We really appreciate it. Currentgeek.com is our website. We again will be back on the 5th of January to bring you more great guests, more great fun. You guys are awesome. Thanks for another great year in the world of current geeking. For me, for Tom, and for all of you, we'll see you next time. Rose back.